Thanks for coming, everybody. My name is Julian Hyde. I'm the original developer of Calcite and PMC member. I work for Hortonworks, and my background is in databases, query optimization, business intelligence. And the main focus of my time is Calcite. So today, this is kind of an extension to Calcite. It's not Calcite's core functionality. I'll describe what Calcite is for those of you not familiar, so you understand how it fits in. But the most of my time will be talking about this new data profiling algorithm. I'll talk about the problem that kind of made me start thinking about this in the first place. This is kind of a story of it's a challenging problem. It's a hard problem that needed an algorithm developed. It's still kind of a research topic. I've been doing some experiments and improving it. It's not done by any means, but we have something workable. It'll be in the next Calcite release. Still plenty of opportunity for improvement. I was talking to Ted Dunning last night, some of you may know Ted, and he was immediately mapping it onto some machine learning problems, and it sounds like he may have some significant improvements for this. So part of the reason for me talking about it is to see if anyone's heard of this problem before and solved it already. So I talk about kind of bringing some new techniques into this, techniques like sketches, information theory, to make the algorithm more tractable. And then I'll talk about some other problems that the algorithm, I think, can be applied to. So first of all, Calcite. It's been a top-level project for a year and a half. It's in use by quite a lot of Apache projects. For example, it powers Hive's cost-based optimizer. It's in Drill. Several of the streaming engines are using Calcite's support, or I should say proposed support for streaming SQL. So engines like Flink and Samza and Apex. It has adapters to connect to various other data sources as well. So it is, you can think of it as a stripped down database. So take a database, remove the actual data store, remove the metadata repository, and even remove the algorithms like the implementation of join and so forth. And what you end up with is a query planning framework where you can give it a query, you can tell it the TANA rules, you can tell it the necessary metadata and statistics, and it will transform that query, the relational algebra of that query, to something that's efficient. And if you kind of model the data sources where the data is held, like this data is held in, for example, the Druid database, then Calcite can apply its planning rules and give you an optimal query for executing this in Druid, or perhaps an optimal plan, which is a hybrid of pushing down as much to Druid as possible and executing the rest in Hive. So Calcite is not competing with these database systems, it's trying to help them. And it's offloading something which was traditionally embedded in the database. Most databases had their own optimizer. We've taken it apart as a separate component, and the result has been that lots of projects, all of whom need a query optimizer, have contributed to it and made it better. It's written in Java. It's packaged as a library. It's very low footprint. It doesn't need its own, repository. So installing it is simply a matter of getting, a couple of jars. And so that makes it very easy to embed in other systems. So, to give you an idea of how Calcite's rules work, here's how it would plan a query. As it happens, this query is a federated query. So we're assuming that we've got Splunk, and the entire Splunk database looks like a table to Calcite, a table with lots of columns. And then we've got another table in a products table in MySQL. So someone has done this joint query combining the MySQL products table and the Splunk table, which is about purchase user actions. And the first thing we do is convert from SQL to relational algebra, so it's a kind of data flow. Reading from left to right, you scan the tables, join, filter, group, and sort. You can kind of see how the SQL query maps onto the relational algebra. So the key thing that makes this all work is the idea of a transformation rule, which takes relational algebra or a fragment of the relational algebra and converts it to an equivalent algebraic expression, which we hope is cheaper. It may not be cheaper. You may actually have to execute a sequence of these transformations to get to something that's cheaper. But the kind of the lowest level operation is a transformation. I'll show you this. So you'll notice that the filter happens after the join, but the filter is depending on a column which comes only from Splunk. So what we'd like to do is push the filter through the join. And so that's what we've done. And we've actually taken, there's two steps happen. We push the filter through the join, and we've also pushed the filter into Splunk. So basically now, a lot less data is coming out of Splunk. So this is a more efficient query, according to virtually any same cost model. So that's two transformations. Actually optimizing a query probably involves hundreds or thousands of transformations. But CalSight provides this environment where you can register these rules, and it has an engine that can apply these rules in the cost model and so forth. So that's what CalSight does. And by the way, I've got a talk with this guy tomorrow afternoon describing integration between basically putting a SQL interface or SQL-like interface on top of PIG. So that's tomorrow at 3:40. But this is the motivating problem for what I'm talking about today. And you'll notice it's a back of the envelope kind of calculation. Everything's a power of 10. Imagine you've got a terabyte database, a disk that can read 1 gigabyte per second, and a query that needs to read a terabyte of data, so 10% of the database. Simply in order to read all of that data, it'd take 1,000 seconds of your disk drive would have to work for 1,000 seconds. So if when you start off all the data's on disk, then that query is going to take a 1,000 seconds to execute. If you parallelize it, put it on 100 disks, 25 machines with 4 disks each, then that query, you can potentially do that query in 10 seconds, assuming there's no communication costs. If you cache the data, then you have a total of a terabyte memory on those 25 machines, then the first query will take 10 seconds. The second query, if you're lucky, will take 10 milliseconds because all the data is in cache. And the third query, 45 minutes later, may take 10 seconds because all the data is being flushed out of the cache. So caching can potentially help, but potentially it can, if you get cache failure, then performance may be bad. If you summarize all the data on disk, then I didn't specify how much data this query is producing, but let's suppose it produces 1,000 rows of data. Then you can store 1,000 rows of data anywhere and read it extremely quickly. So 100 milliseconds or probably even faster. And by materialize, I basically mean pre-execute the query and store the results somewhere, which is tantamount to cheating. It's like doing an exam by already knowing what the answers are. But this is all about cheating, right? Is building an index cheating? I don't know. One of the problems with materialization is you need a database administrator or someone to figure out what materializations should exist, to make sure they're populated, to invalidate them if the underlying data is changed, and so on and so forth. Even cheating isn't easy. And then the last one is you don't really know what the questions are going to be. So, you know, we'd like to have some kind of combination of materialization and caching and adapting. So what about if we were to materialize data and store it in memory rather than on disk? And if that particular materialized data is invalid or is no one's using it anymore, we throw it away. And what about if people start asking new questions that they haven't asked before we create new materializations on the fly? This is clearly a very nice thing if we can build it, but it requires intelligence about the patterns of query use and the patterns of the data, and how large is the summary going to be before we build it? How do we figure out what are the right set of summaries to build? So
this algorithm is trying to help solve that problem.
So. Yeah, so we've moved from optimizing queries to optimizing data. I'd argue, you want to reorganize your data, create materializations and so forth, to give the query optimizer, a fighting chance when the queries actually arrive. So this idea of materialized view, materialization, it's been around for a very long time. I would argue even something like an index is a form of materialization. You've sorted the data by a particular key. So that you can access it by key ranges very efficiently rather than having to scan the whole table. But I'm mainly concerned with summary tables. So basically, materializations that store join group by groups. Those are very useful for OLAP kinds of applications. They also tend to be very much smaller than the original data set. So, the cost of storing those, on disk or potentially even in memory is relatively small. So they can have huge improvements in the query runtime. So in order to make these work, we have to solve several challenges, and they're all pretty challenging. So which materializations to create, how do I populate them with data initially? When the data changes, how do I incrementally populate them? When a query arrives, how do I figure out what materializations could potentially be used to satisfy this? And how do I, transform the query so that it gives the same results? How do I create new materializations when new queries arrive, or perhaps a query that people used to execute once a day is no longer executed? And in all of this, in the presence of a rich algebra, so you want to be able to support the full relational algebra plus things like UDFs and so forth and a rich type system. So it's not enough to just recognize queries which contain, select from where. You need to be able to support group buying, order buying, and so forth. So mainly focusing on summary tables here. And mainly focused on the question of how do we decide which are the appropriate materializations to create. So there's this structure called a lattice, which it's a mathematical structure, a partially ordered set is another word for it, or lattice is a form of partially ordered set. But it naturally arises when you look at what possible group buys can exist. So the raw data at the bottom, let's suppose we've got a million rows of data, and we have just five columns. Zip code, which has 43,000 values, if you're looking at the US. Year has five, and month has 12 values. This is a million rows of data. If I just say group by gender, the query will return two rows, so this is what this G2 means. If I say group by gender and year, this data set has 5 years, two genders, you're going to get 10 rows back. So as you can see, the highly aggregated data is at the top of this, and the very little aggregated data is at the bottom. So this is grouped by all of the columns. We've got almost a million rows. So each of these ellipses here is a potential summary table that one could create. And the question is, and there's 32 of them, right? 2 to the power 5. The question is, which are the optimal ones? This is an algorithm that was, designed, I think, 20 years ago now. And by the way, there were some interesting patterns in this data. So, gender and year are independent. So there are 10 values, 2 times 5. Zip code and state are really interesting because it so happens there are a few zip codes in the US that cross state boundaries. There aren't very many. So zip code is almost functionally dependent on the state. State is almost functionally dependent on zip code. Given the zip code, most of the time I can tell you what state it belongs to. Which means that the number of zip code and state combined is almost the same as the number of zip codes. So I'd be crazy to create a summary table for zip code. I would really, for a few extra rows, I can model zip code and state, and so I can use that to execute queries which are grouped by state, in addition to queries which are grouped by zip code.
So
this is why we're so interested in computing cardinalities, is so we can find stuff like this.
So
here's the algorithm, as I say, it's based on work at, I think, Stanford 20 years ago. Let's suppose we have 30 columns. We're interested in finding summary tables. You know, let's suppose we have a budget of a certain amount of disk space, we can populate the summary tables. Find the optimal set of summary tables given an expected query load. We have one it's already there at Calcite. It's called Adaptive Monte Carlo. So it takes an expected query load. It models that query load using Monte Carlo simulation, and it's a greedy algorithm, which means that it has. It starts off with a particular set of summary tables and says, what's the best summary table to incrementally add to this, and which will yield the best incremental improvement over this set of tables. So the algorithm's fine. It's just...
We need to feed the beast.
This algorithm, in order to function, needs a large statistic.
So let's just see how the algorithm runs.
So these are the ones that it chooses, and you know, surprise, it's taken the zip code and state and says, well, I'm going to add gender, which actually multiplies the number of records by almost 2. What you'll notice is virtually any path down from the top of the lattice to the bottom, you're going to hit an orange ellipse, which is good. It's basically what it's trying to do is cover the set of possible queries. So virtually any group by clause, you will hit a summary. And so if someone does a query on zip code, because this is directly below it, you can roll up
the results.
And so these are the approximate numbers. 50% of the queries could be covered by this summary table, which is on state and gender and year and month. But of course, it's quite a large summary table, so it's not going to yield as much. If you've got a query which is just on year and month, then it's not going to yield as much of an advantage as this one, which is aggregated specifically on year and month. Feeding the beast. If you've got 30 columns, that's 2 to the 30 possible combinations of columns that you could summarize on. So this algorithm potentially could ask for 2 to the 30 countersinked queries, which is, if we implement this in a naive way, it's going to have to do 2 to the 30 table scans. Clearly ridiculous. I'm going to explain an approach based on sketches, which makes it significantly cheaper. And then the next one, which is the algorithm we've got here, includes sketches, and we also use some ideas from information theory to reduce the cost even further. Oh, by the way, an important thing of this, which is what makes approximations, what makes sketches applicable, is approximations are okay. We're fine if the actual cardinality of zip code and state is 45,000, and the estimator tells us 44,900. It's perfectly fine. There are other applications where you really want the exact count distinct.
And sucks to be you in that case. So sketches are, who's aware of sketches on Hyperlocklock?
Okay. Sketches are a very cool innovation. It's rare that something new comes along. And sketches are a very cool area of research that I think really started to make an impact about 10 years ago. So there's a family of algorithms, which Hyperlocklock is specialized on proximate distinct count, but there are other algorithms that can do things like approximate histograms, that kind of thing. So what Hyperlocklock can do is it can count, if you have a data set that's, you know, has a billion distinct values, it doesn't matter how many rows, you'll have a trillion rows or so forth, but you can estimate the number of distinct values in that column using only 1.5 kilobytes of memory. So it's using a very, very compact proximate data structure. And furthermore, you can compose it. So you can analyze half your data over here and compute a sketch, a 1.5 kilobyte sketch. You can analyze another half of your data over here using a 1.5 kilobyte sketch. Each of those sketches has a typical error rate of 2%. You combine those sketches together into a new sketch, and that still has an error rate of about 2%. So this algorithm can, not only is it efficient in terms of memory, it can be parallelized. It parallelizes perfectly. You can divide your data up into very small pieces. Or indeed, if you're building a summary table, you can compute the summary, the number of distinct customers in Texas and the number of, number of distinct customers who have blue eyes and number of distinct customers who have green eyes, combine them together and go find out the number of distinct customers. So you can combine these sketch results. Composability is a very powerful and useful feature of these things. So using sketches, rather than computing one distinct count at a time, I can, with 60 megabytes of memory per node, I can compute 10,000 sketches, 10,000 combinations of columns using 1.5K for each one. So now we're down from 10 to the 9 to 10 to the 5 passes over our data. So we're kind of chewing up this data at a much greater rate, but we've still got a long way to go, right?
So
the next step is to bring in information theory into this. So we've got this notion that I call surprise. If you know already that gender has two distinct values, I know it doesn't, but state has 50 values, then I told you the number of gender and state combinations is 100, then you wouldn't be surprised at all. There's no real information in that because that's the value you would expect. Conversely, state and zip code, you would be surprised to find out that there are only 43,400 state zip code combinations. Where, the number you would expect, assuming state and zip code are independent, then you'd expect this number, 799,666.7, which is almost 800,000, but it's a little bit below because there's only a million rows. So because the pool of rows is finite, that means the number of combinations is a little bit lower. So it has a surprise, but I use this formula for surprise, actual minus expected divided by actual plus expected. According to that, that's a surprising value. So that's something we want to remember. It's provided this information. I'm using this formula here to basically figure out the number of expected values of an attribute. If you've got a million rows and the attribute can take 900,000 possible values, then you'd expect some lingering about 890,000 of those values to occur in the million row sample that you have. And so this applies not to just the one and two column combinations, but three column combinations and so forth. So if we know state zip code, gender state, and gender zip code combinations, we can come up with an estimate for the gender state and zip code combination, which is the minimum of all of the pairwise combinations. And then again, we can compute this, and it turns out that now this kind of all the surprise has gone out of this. We've already had the surprise in the state and zip code combination. The three-way combination is now no longer surprising.
Which is good. What we're trying to do is drive all of the. We're trying to reduce this model to the smallest amount of information, and therefore we'll stop looking at the parts of it that are not interesting. So
here's the basic algorithm. We set the surprise threshold to 1, and I'll go more into the threshold later. But basically, this is something that allows us to stop to determining the algorithm early. So we're interested in looking at the top of the lattice, the singleton combination, so you know the individual columns. We remove the first few items of the queue and then go and do this as in a batch. And we're assuming, you know, 10,000 entries at a time. It's basically based on the amount of memory we have. We compute the cardinality of each of those, and when we get the results back, we find which ones of them are surprising. And if the surprise is greater than our threshold, then we will do two things. First of all, we'll store it in the model that we return. And secondly, we will now investigate the children of that. So if we found out, for example, that, at the first level, everything is deemed surprising because you don't know anything about the cardinality of columns. But, you know, that zip code state combination, we would deem it useful to go look at the children of zip code and state. The year and month isn't surprising, so we wouldn't then go to look at year and month and day because that's not likely to be surprising. And then we increase the surprise thresholds because as we go further through this algorithm, we are less interested in looking at very large combinations of columns. So we're using surprise here in three distinct ways. First of all, we don't need to store it in the model. So that the actual model we're going to output will be smaller. We don't want a model which has 2 to the power of 30 different cardinalities in it. We want a model with preferably like 100 cardinalities from which we can derive approximately all of the other ones. If the combination is surprising, and this is an unproven hypothesis, so if you can disprove this, let me know. But if a combination of columns is not surprising, then its children are unlikely to be surprising. And lastly, if we see surprising results, we should stop the algorithm.
So here's a graph of the actual run of the algorithm. Let me explain what's going on here. So this is the first iteration of the algorithm. And in fact, the first batch is probably up to about here.
So these dots here are us evaluating cardinalities of all the singleton columns. And surprise, surprise, they all are very surprising because we don't know ahead of time that the state column has 50 values. So, and here is our surprise threshold. So initially, we are, again, we've taken the previous phase, the surprise threshold starts at 0. In other words, we will accept anything. But as the algorithm runs, then we start rejecting things. These things are below the threshold. They're not sufficiently surprising to be kept and acted upon. So this line rises, and it's kind of it's self-tuning. It's based on the surprise of the last 100 entries that we've accepted. So it starts rising here. There's some interesting kind of clusters in here that I'm not really sure about, like the whole bunch of things that have the same surprising list. I don't know the cause. I suspect it's because I'm working on a data set here which has some. First of all, it's a synthetic data set. So somebody used a random number generator to generate this stuff. And secondly, there's denormalized relations inside it. So we might be seeing things of similar cardinalities. At any rate, I guess another kind of unsolved problem here is, what's the right point to stop? This algorithm actually ran through to completion, but you know, maybe here will be able to, you know, a good time to stop the algorithm.
So one of the main findings of this is that
hierarchies are not as useful for the design of an OLAP database, or as you might think. So it's been the kind of received wisdom, and definitely in multidimensional databases, that hierarchies were an essential part of what made them efficient. And I maintain that hierarchies, so an example of a hierarchy is a product hierarchy, product, manufacturer, brand, and so forth. All the time hierarchy, year, month, day, actually time has often this kind of dual hierarchies, like, you know, year and week, for example. So the received wisdom was that hierarchies had two purposes. One is for your end user to double click on a year and automatically see the months, and double click on a month and see the days in the month. So it just makes it easy to use the user interface. And the other was, by organizing the data in hierarchies, it allows us to create these summary tables that would roll up really easily. And that when you're creating your database, you need to spend a lot of effort defining these hierarchies in order for the database to be able to self-tune. And you know, Kylin, for example, is you know, there's a lot of discussion on the and a lot of documentation about how to create the right set of hierarchies. I would claim that, you know, this case of the almost hierarchy occurs surprisingly often. And from a physical perspective, from a user interface perspective, you don't probably want to double click on this, you don't necessarily want to double click on the state and see what the zip codes. But from a storage perspective, this is almost as useful as a true hierarchy. So I think the almost hierarchies, which can be discovered, all of these things can be discovered by the algorithm. I don't think we should be telling database administrators to spend a whole lot of time defining hierarchies before they start populating their database. I think the database should figure it out for themselves. And which means that hierarchies are now just something, just a preference you have in your user interface, and they're not part of the underlying data model. And the simpler data model, as we all know, is better, right? So, yeah, I think I've said a lot of that.
So,
the main motivating example was choosing the right set of summary tables, but this algorithm, I think, can be applied to some other areas. First of all, in query optimization. So, you know, I've been talking about data optimization, query optimization. Join, Llamas still really suck at optimizing join queries, especially large join queries. If you've got a query with a six-way join, after it's performed the five-way join, it optimizer basically doesn't, the marketing folks won't tell you this, but the optimizer basically doesn't have a freaking clue what data's gonna come out of that five-way join. You know, when you've done a two-way join, it kind of knows the cardinality of the underlying columns, and it has a reasonable estimate of the number of rows that are going to come out of that two-way join. By the time you got to the five-way join, kind of all bets are off. It doesn't know whether you're going to get a billion rows or three rows. And this is kind of because the statistics get so distorted after you pass them through multiple joins that they're kind of closely, they're just noise. So these kind of multi-column statistics help a lot in reducing the amount of noise in kind of later stages of join optimization. There's a new benchmark which specifically addresses this issue of, oh, by the way, optimizers on benchmark queries like TPCBS tend to do really well. And part of the reason is because those are synthetic data sets. They're generated by random number generators. And there are very few, or there are no, unexpected relationships between columns. So this problem is basically being met.
Shut up.
This problem is basically being masked through the benchmarks because they're running on synthetic data sets. So the joy loader benchmark takes a data set which is extracted from the Internet Movie Database. And it doesn't run queries, it basically asks, it runs optimizers and says how many rows do you think this is going to produce. So it tests the accuracy of the optimizer statistics. Actually running the queries up, but that is kind of irrelevant. So it discovers things like movies made by French directors tend to have French actors. In other words, the nation column of the producer of the movie and the nation column of the actor in the movie, there's a strong correlation between those. In a synthetic data set, there'll be no correlation whatsoever. But you know, if you're executing a real query and you've done multiple levels of joins, that's a very useful thing for the optimizer to know. So I haven't tried this algorithm on this benchmark, but it would be very interesting. The other thing is optimizing group by queries, especially in Hadoop, or in fact in any kind of massively distributed data platform, which has something like a reducer. Getting the number of reducers right is crucial, which means you really need to know to a fair accuracy how many rows are going to come out of that group by query. If you get it wrong, if you overestimate the number of reducers, you're going to end up with a lot of small files. If you underestimate the number of reducers, you're going to, your one reducer is not going to be able to, is going to become the bottleneck. So another is for humans. If you're a consultant and you arrive on a site, you want to grok the data set, you want to understand this database. This would be a good tool to apply to just find things like functional dependencies. Oh, this table is denormalized because all of these columns are functionally dependent on this column. This algorithm can do that. If there are problems in data quality, then this algorithm can potentially help with that. And I have a feeling there are applications in machine learning. If you discover that one attribute is unexpectedly influenced by this other attribute, then potentially you could use this to predict that.
So, how about the time? Several possible further improvements in this algorithm, doing more stuff in parallel.
This algorithm could be run in a distributed framework like Spark or MapReduce or anything else. The algorithm doesn't depend on a particular framework. I know the Hive team is interested in histograms, as histograms combined with multi-column statistics. A whole bunch of extra work. If you want to play around with this, then you're more than welcome. I have a feeling there could be some papers, research papers in this, if you're that way inclined.
That's all I have.
Any questions?
Okay, thank you.